Hello, and welcome to Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me to discuss minutes 40 through 45 of Citizen Kane is producer Corey Musa. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me here.
I am very happy to have you here on the show. We've done a bunch of podcasts before, so this is always cool when I have a chance to talk to you, especially to talk about movies, since you are a genuine Hollywood movie producer. It's very exciting.
It's true. It's true. I'm going to have insight onto this film that's going to just blow your mind with my, impressive background.
Looking forward to that. Now, I'm going to assume, Corey, that, in your adventures in Hollywood, having produced films and hobnobbed with Hollywood actors and big name people, that everyone out there in Hollywood is completely in love with Citizen Kane, and it's a movie they talk about all the time, and everyone refers to it as an inspiration, right? Tell me that that's the truth.
Honestly, most people probably would talk about it that way. I know plenty of people that wouldn't talk about it that way.
So, well, when did you first see Citizen Kane?
I first saw Citizen Kane on television at some point when I was a little kid. And I probably didn't watch it all the way through, and I was probably really bored. It was probably just on like Sunday afternoon on one of these like movie cinema things that happened on Sunday afternoons on like network television. And then I guess the real first time that I saw it and paid attention, I was like 18 years old. I was a freshman at college. I was at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And on Friday nights, they had this theater on campus that generally ran movies that had been playing in the movie theater just a couple months earlier. And it was like before they were on home video at this point. So we would get them on campus a little bit early. And they were sometimes like weird cuts of the movie. I remember once seeing this movie and like you could see the boom mic in the cut, and you were just like, how's that possible? It was what was that movie called? I think it was called like Sleepers or something like that. It was like
the De Niro movie and Jason Patrick, that movie. I think that was called Sleepers.
I'm thinking of Brad Pitt.
Yeah, he was in that. Yeah
okay. And Ron Eldard, yeah. There was like the boom mic in that, and we were just like, "What? Why can we see that? It's so funny." And I don't know, maybe it just wasn't a formatted cut or something. So I see Citizen Kane one, and it's like normally they're playing new movies, but they're not playing a new movie this week, I guess, and they're playing Citizen Kane. And like my best friend at school, like dragged me, and he was like a real cinephile and really introduced me to a lot about, you know, filmmaking that I didn't know anything about. I was in college for theater at the time. So we go see Citizen Kane in, I think it was called the McConaughey Auditorium, McConaughey Auditorium. And there it was, like on a big screen for me. First time I'm really seeing it. Black and white film that I'm seeing in the context as more of an adult for the first time, but still way too young to appreciate it. And I was mostly confused. I remember asking a ton of questions to my friend because I didn't understand. I was like, why does anybody care about this? Why is this a big deal? Like, who cares? It's like a movie about like some dude who died and this is the story of his life. Like, why would I care about that? And then we start, you know, talking about it in terms of filmmaking, in terms of really at that moment, I was talking about cinematography. And I didn't know anything about cinematography, and it opened up probably the first door into that aspect of filmmaking for me. Yeah, that was kind of my introduction to Citizen Kane, and I've seen it a couple times again over the years. It's been a while. I rewatched it earlier today, and I was just having so much fun watching it, and it was probably the most I've ever appreciated it. You know what, Rob? I don't think I'd actually watched it since I had begun a career in film, and I really was from like a strong theater background until I was, you know, about 30 years old, and then everything transferred over to film. And yeah, seeing this after everything that I have done now is like, I could appreciate it on so many different levels that I just wasn't understanding that 18-year-old version of me when I was in college.
So. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was I've seen documentaries about movies where a lot of times the prep work by the director or the producer or the writer is like, hey, everybody, let's go watch a bunch of movies that are in some way similar to what we're going to be working on, or maybe just something you want to get the feel of it. I remember there's a documentary about Magnolia where Paul Thomas Anderson screens Network for everybody and stuff like that. And like, I'm trying to think, like, in all the movies that you've produced over the years, have you ever had somebody doing that? Like one of the director or someone say, hey, let's watch a bunch of movies because this is kind of what I'm going for. And the reason I'm even asking that is like, I could see somebody saying, hey, let's watch Citizen Kane because it's so inspirational. At the same time, that's really taking a big swing to say, hey, let's watch Citizen Kane because that's kind of what we're trying to do here. Like, wow, right. that's a bold.
No, and I think like, and to answer your question, no, I haven't. I haven't actually had that experience. We're just so freaking busy in prep and in production. Like, there'd be no time to sit and watch movies. And it's like weird. I've gotten to the point now when I'm making something where it's hard for me to watch something while I'm making it because you're trying to keep your perspective on what you're doing. And you're trying not to, you know, me as the producer, I'm there trying to protect the director and make sure everything is going according to the way it should be going on set throughout the day. And I don't want to start putting ideas in somebody's head because I was watching a movie and I had a thought about it the night before. Mm. However, that said, like when it comes to first time filmmaking, when it comes to like guerrilla style, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm going to go make a movie right now. There's like no other way to actually do it than to kind of give the love to the movies that have inspired you and to borrow from them, to try and understand how they did a shot and to recreate that, to make it your own. And, you know, in terms of what Citizen Kane is and who Orson Welles was and where he was coming from at the Mercury Theater in New York City, you know, and it's like nobody knew what they were doing when they made that movie, which is why there's so many aspects of it that work really well. It's like Greg Tolan, the cinematographer, was like, you know, probably the adult on set.
Yeah, right.
The person who actually had a significant background, like, and I looked him up today and I was like, holy moly, this guy did over 65 films before he did in the 15 years, 65 films before he did Kane. That's ridiculous.
Can you imagine that? How the amount of skill you get to develop by just doing something that repeatedly and in that short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, if you just do the math, he had to be doing one after another. And it's like he would, you know, he's there for production. He shoots and he's out. He shoots and he's out. But he's the most important part of production. And probably throughout, you know, that 15 years of working on so many films, there was probably so much fighting happening with so many directors and not being able to have the ability to, like, utilize all of the different things that he was learning in a, you know, in a space, in an area that was still pretty new. And now here comes along Orson Welles and, you know, the Mercury Theater players, and somehow they've managed to get the studio to finance like this passion project almost. And Greg Toland is like, and they tell Greg Toland, like, you know, you can take the lead. They were smart. They were smart that way. And then everything else, I think, would have been a matter of like, they had no reason to know that they couldn't do any of the things that they were doing. Like, they hadn't been up against it yet. Orson Welles and whoever he was working with. Like, there's a magic, I think, that I see in that movie that is part of the night, like being being ignorant to like a lot of tropes, being ignorant to a lot of BS behind the scenes and just saying, why can't we do that? Why can't we do this?
Right.
And then just kind of really being passionate about it and standing behind that. Why can't we do it? And getting it. And which is, by the way, like, that's a move that, you know, works with a lot of people. Like, it's like a confident person. That's who you want carrying a film, is somebody who you believe has an actual vision of what it's all going to be when it comes together. And you want that person to be that confident. And that's what he was. And that, I think, that hubris, a lot of it had to just come from youth and like raw energy from all of this interesting work that they were doing before Citizen Kane came to be.
Yeah, there's a marvelous quote from Orson Welles about people asked him, like, how were you so confident at 25? And he said, I wasn't so much confident, I was as ignorant. And he says, when you get older, you lose the ignorance because you have life experiences and you start seeing what can happen. And he's like, the way you can still produce great work in your older age is you have to recapture that ignorance, which is hard to do because you've got it. You don't have it anymore, but you have to be able to sort of have that kind of just, okay, I could just, let's just try it. Let's just try it and see what happens. And he said, that's how he was able to do it. And,
I can relate to that in such a personal way, which is why I feel like I can understand this film differently now, you know.
Sure.
My first film was a hit, which is a rare thing to have happen. And I had a real budget when I got to do my first film was Margin Call, which was like a political, financial thriller kind of. I don't know if thriller is the right word. It was suspenseful, but it was about the financial collapse. And the movie got a lot of attention and it got a bunch of different awards and nominations, Academy nominations. And I can tell you that me, my producing partners, the director, like we did not know what we were doing at all. And there was definite hubris that was happening in terms of why can't we do it? Why can't I just do anything? I don't understand. And it's like everything worked out great on Margin Call. And we really embraced like learning what we were doing while we were doing it. But yeah, if I had to recreate that, which guess what? I do. I try and recreate that all the time. It's like impossible now. I'm thinking about 500 different things than I was thinking about when I made Margin Call, like that I can't help but think about now in terms of what's involved in making a movie and thinking about the bigger picture in a way that my mind wasn't capable of thinking about the bigger picture when I was on my first film. So I feel like all of that, like kind of raw, creative, like awesome energy got to be thrown into Citizen Kane. And it's kind of how you ended up with this excellent piece of cinema.
Do you think it's the greatest film of all time? Do you think it deserves that title?
I think it's a great, great example of like great, great filmmaking and like really solid use of all sorts of things that you can do with the camera, with your actors. Like, it's like such a great example of everything. I don't think it's like the greatest film ever made. I can't. It won't ever speak to me that way. I'm not a product of like the 1940s, and I have other things that resonate with me creatively on a more personal level that I think are better examples of work.
Like Margin Call.
No. I'm not allowed to say that. I would say Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan is a fairly perfect piece of filmmaking.
Wow. Okay. That's a bold choice. I mean, I love that movie.
That was the movie when I was a kid that I watched. I literally watched it over and over again. I watch it like 10 times in a day. I don't know why. I just want to watch that one over and over again. So it's like Citizen Kane can't be my favorite film. It just can't be, but I appreciate it.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. So we're here to talk about minutes 40 to 45 of Citizen Kane. It opens with Kane, Leland, and Bernstein in the window of the Inquirer, and it's going to end with Bernstein and Leland talking about their newspaper's policies. So the opening sequence is our three sort of protagonists here looking at the circulation of their newspaper, which is at 26,000. And then they are across the street at the Chronicle. And they see the Chronicle circulation is 495,000. And of course, you know, this was a style back then where you would paint the circulation of a newspaper on the window. And nowadays, of course, no one would do anything like that because the information is changing so rapidly. We live in a world where numbers are moving so fast. But back then, you could sort of brag about that, like 26,000. That's a pretty good number. But 495,000 is an even greater number. And of course, Kane is wondering, why can't we get that circulation? Why can't we have these people? And we see that the Chronicle has this august staff. And there's this photo of these 10 old men in their suits. And it's this frame picture and it says the Chronicle staff, the greatest newspaper staff in the world. And it's this shot that is, again, one of the, you know, like we were talking about, like, why not? Why not try this? This right. is something you really wouldn't see, where the camera slowly pans into this shot of these 10 men. And it's a still photo. And then there's a very sort of subtle fade. And we see all of a sudden we are in a real shot where these are the 10 men are really standing there. And they're, Wells has directed them to be perfectly still. So if you're not paying close attention, you don't really know that you're not looking at a photo anymore until Kane walks in front of them. And he talks about that he wanted his candy.
Think about what that would have been like for the people who were lucky enough to have actually seen it in the theater, like when it first came out.
Oh, man, it would have been a head trip.
Yeah, you would have been like, holy cow. There was so much of that cinematography going on in this movie. And that's just like a perfect example of probably Greg Toland being like, I got this trick I think we can pull off. And then doing it. Or the other thing about like Citizen Kane, I know we have to talk about this 5 minutes. It's just that like, this is a case of like fans. These are fans of the medium. Orson Welles, the actors he's working with. And they want to do it better. Mm-hmm. They've seen what they've seen, and they're stealing. They're stealing a ton of stuff that they're doing in this, and they're doing it better. They're like, well, why can't – it's like instead of the Hollywood rush job that some of these movies that were being made before Citizen Kane, the attention to detail on this is – it's enormous. It showed what you can actually do. With ideas and feelings and shots and setups that you'd already seen played with. Now this guy is like, if we just practice this, I think we can master it, which I don't think anybody else was doing at the time, like rehearsing their takes, not often anyway.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary sequence. And as far as I understand of how it was done is that it was reverse printed, is that it's the shot as we're seeing it went backwards, is that it started with the live action guys and then they faded into the photograph. They took a photograph of them and then reverse printed it. So they were actually, they started with the live guys and then faded it into the photograph. But in the way you see it in the film, it's reversed. So you're starting at the photograph, you're going to the guys. And he said, this feels like something Toland would have done or something he could have brought to Wells and say, I think we could try this. They could try this. And it is really is mind bending to where you really are. You're looking at a solid still photo and then a live actor walks in the middle of it. And it just feels very, very strange.
Yeah. And if you have a minute to think about like what the character of like Charlie Kane has done in this moment, it's like he's like an artist. He's a crazy person. It's like the idea to me is like, that was the picture of those guys at the Inquirer, right? That they're looking at on the wall that's framed. And he's like, I'm going to hire all of those guys. And then he takes the same picture of them. Mm-hmm. He takes the same exact pose that they're in. And he's like, now they're mine. And he's like, send that to the Inquirer. And or Examiner or whatever.
The Chronicle.
Chronicle. I'm saying the wrong one. I knew I was saying the wrong one. And that's like really interesting to me. I'm like, oh, well, that's like a real F you that you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
You just poached all of their writers. And now you're sending them this photo that you're like, and you made all of the writers get in the exact same position and take the same exact photo. You asked them to wear the same outfit. I mean, if you really think about it, like that's technically what the character of Charles Kane was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right. It's an amazing dick move. And he's really smug about it where he talks about the, you know, I finally got my candy, referring to these guys as his candy. And he does. He has that comment about send a copy of the photo to the Inquirer. I do want to mention the actor playing the photographer who doesn't actually have a line, but we see him. He's the old timey guy with the big, that light fixture, the big, you know, the shutter or whatever it is, the bulbs. Yeah. It's a guy named Robert Dudley. He passed away in 1955. He has a pretty amazing filmography. He obviously was really good friends with Preston Sturges, the great Preston Sturges, because he's in a bunch of Preston Sturges movies. He's in The Palm Beach Story, Sullivan's Travels, The Great Moment, and Miracle at Morgan's Creek. So obviously big Dress and Surges was very impressed with Robert Dudley. But man, again, what if, you know, for a guy who's, you look through his IMDb profile and he's mostly uncredited in most movies or doesn't have a line. But I mean, man, imagine saying I was in Sullivan's Travels and Citizen Kane. Like, yes. just that by yourself, like that by itself is enough for that's a hell of a career. You know, I mean, my good Lord. And so all these guys, all these Inquirer guys, they're now formerly Chronicle guys. Now they're Inquirer guys. They're all laughing heartily at Welles' jokes because obviously he's their new boss. And if that wasn't bad enough, we see this giant ice keg that has been poised on this table with the Welcome to the New Inquirer staff newspaper kind of frozen inside of it. And, you know, we are only a couple of minutes removed from Kane declaring his principles and talking very high-minded about how this paper is going to be the fight for the common man, fight for the little guy. They're going to get an honest story. And here he is pretty unattractive in terms of he's just being the cock of the walk and just so smug. And you're like, wow, this guy is already losing touch with what he just set out to do just a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah, no, this is the moment. I mean, this is the moment, I think, for Kane, if he looks back on his own life, that is like, this is maybe his happiest time as an adult. This kind of moment right here, where he's got everybody's attention, he's holding court, everybody's laughing at all of his jokes, and then what's about to happen is just like going to be a monument to him. So, and, you know, Welles himself is having way too much fun doing this scene.
Yeah,
this this is fun.
Yeah.
This day was crazy. This day was fun. There was a whole bunch of people in the room this day. Man, can you imagine how smoky that?
Oh, well, yeah. The reverse shot that we get over the shoulder of Welles, as we see, he is at the top of this, the head of this very, very long table. There are about, I think, 25 people in this shot. And at the end of it is Mr. Bernstein, and we see Jed Leland at the very bottom. And it's all of the staff of the Inquirer, and they're all smoking. And this is, again, you know, a real tour de force for Greg Toland, in that if you take any still image of this shot, of this scene, and I'm looking at it right now, like right around the 41-minute mark, you can make out the faces of every one of these people. And that's the deep focus photography of Greg Toland, is that you can make out every one of these guys, which is nearly impossible to do.
Right. Yeah. Can you imagine? And manually pulling that focus to do it all with, you know, focus pullers. It is impressive. I hadn't even thought about that.
So my favorite story about Greg Toland is that apparently as they were setting out to do Kane, he told Orson Welles that he could teach him everything he needed to know about cinematography in a single weekend. And apparently they spent 3 or 4 days just going through everything so he could teach Orson all the stuff that he wanted to sort of learn. Now, obviously, there's a bit of hyperbole there, but I thought that really reveals an incredible amount of confidence in Greg Toland that he could say that about his own craft like that. I mean, you would think someone who's insecure and wants to sort of maybe hide the tricks because they're afraid of somebody learning it would want to cover that up. But Greg Toland was like, no, I can teach you everything. Now, obviously, again, Toland's the cinematographer. Welles didn't shoot it himself. He's not Steven Soderberghing it here. But nevertheless, I thought that's – Toland was that confident. And like you were talking about, this is what, his 60th film? He knows what he's doing.
He probably – it's like he's probably had that conversation with a bunch of directors who did not want to go have that conversation with him, who did not want to probably respect or honor just how hard that person worked. And, you know, it's like – that's one of the most important people who makes the entire movie is the cinematographer. If it's an inexperienced director, that person is going to carry the movie in a lot of ways. If your director is acting in the movie, the cinematographer is going to become like a really, really important person. And, you know, sometimes they get to work with people that understand how vital they are to the project. And sometimes they work with people who just think of them as like cattle, and, you know, they just are telling them, nope, do this, do that. I don't care. I don't care what you think. I don't care what your opinion is. Let's just go. Let's just move, move, move. So I bet you that they had, I bet you they probably had a great relationship making this film. I bet you
I mean, he gives him it. Doesn't he give him the shared card at the end of the movie?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would have been unheard of at the time, somebody doing that. So it's like,
I think people's egos on this movie were actually kind of small. It's like Toland having that conversation with Wells is probably like imposter syndrome kicking in. Him just being like, I'm just a fraud. Like, anybody can do what I do. So I'll just tell this guy how I do it if he wants to hear how I do it. And it's like Wells has like the last credit. I was looking this up when I was watching the credits today. He takes like the last actor credit.
Basically. Yeah. Kane, .. Orson Welles.
Which is amazing. So, you know, there could have been, and look, for 1954, there could have been a lot more ego in this movie. 1941, I mean, why did I say 54? I think 54 is when they re-released it or something. So yeah, no, sorry to focus just on this one shot, but
no, I mean, no pun intended. It really is. There's so many shots of this that are Greg Toland putting something where this film looks different in a way that you can't quite put your finger on until you learn it, until you hear it. You're like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. I'm seeing all this stuff in focus that I wouldn't normally see. My eye isn't normally trained to look like that in movies. There's this great close up of, Jed and Bernstein, and we see behind them are these ice sculptures of them, this most absurd caricature of these ice sculptures. And again, it's like these guys are really sort of all falling in love with each other and their own egos and stuff. And at one point, Bernstein even has the joke about, there's a bunch of promises. You're not intending to keep them, are you, Mr. Kane? And they're sort of laughing about all the stuff that Kane said he was about. And, you know, on the one end, you're kind of like, are they serious? Are they really crapping on all the stuff they just talked about? Or are they just sort of having poking fun at themselves? And we get a sense, again, that how outsized Mr. Kane's ego is because right after this initial scene of them talking, where Kane even says, I made a bunch of promises. You don't expect me to keep them, do you, Mr. Bernstein? We break into a musical number. I mean, this film has everything. It has musical number, and it's a song about Charles Foster Kane, presumably written by Charles Foster Kane. So he's writing a song about himself, and one of the things
he had to have written it by himself, delivered it to the girls, like, and had them learn it because he knows the lyrics. Shouldn't know. So he had to have written it himself, and he's like really pleased with himself. It's really funny, and he does make all those promises, and he does end up buying a bunch of statues later, doesn't he?
Yeah, basically, yes, he does.
Like promises, he says something about buying statues. It was something that I don't think I had caught before when I'd seen this, and I thought that
was kind of funny. About going to Europe, yeah, and he's like, they've been making statues for 2,000 years. I've only been buying them for 30.
Right.
But one of the fun little tricks in this scene, again, probably courtesy of maybe Toland or maybe the set designer, is that of course we see that they're in this copy room, they're in the newspaper offices, and we can see from some of the shots that the ceiling is barely above Orson Welles's head. Orson Welles was not that tall a guy. I think he was about six foot. And so you're like, well, wait a minute, why are the ceilings are incredibly low? And that's of course because they have the muslin ceilings right above them so they could put the boom mics on the other side of the muslin so they could pick up the audio, but you don't risk seeing the boom mics, unlike, say, in Sleepers. They're all
That's so cool. That's like, see, those are details that I'm not even aware of. And of course, like, that's stuff they would have done back then, and then he would have wanted to have had those big cinematic shots where you're getting like that long, like almost fisheye view of the room, which you couldn't do if you had mics in your shot.
Right.
It would ruin everything. So it's super impressive.
Yeah. And so they get this song and dance about, you know, what is his name? Charlie Kane. And I tried to figure out who the guy is singing. He's in this sort of straw boater hat. He looks like a barbershop quartet kind of guy. And unfortunately, on IMDb, there are no less than 33 people credited as man singing at Enquirer Party. So, and a bunch of them do not have IMDb photos. So I could not figure out who this guy is, who is actually doing all the singing. Now, these other people in the background are sort of singing along and going, ha, ha, ha. But the guy here, the main guy, he's singing the main part of the song, but I could not figure out who it is, unfortunately. I initially thought it was a guy named Guy Gatta, who only has one credit, which is Citizen Kane, but I don't know. And also there's a bunch of girls credited as the dancers, and they're in these little short little outfits and stuff. And we see that everybody is just having a really great time. And there's this initial close-up of Bernstein and Jed Leland as they're singing the song. And there's one thing I've noticed about the Joseph Cotton as Jed Leland, as he's singing, is he's kind of, even though everybody here is really going crazy and they're just having a raucous time, he's starting to look a little skeptical. He's starting to look a little side-eye at his friend here. And of course, sure, it's going to lead to this conversation. But even before the dialogue kicks in, I get the sense that Jed Leland is already, he's there for the party and he's enjoying the ice sculpture and the cigars, but he's already starting to kind of be like, what am I looking at here?
Yeah, he's the Judas to the Jesus. And, you know, he's seeing trouble now. He's like, you're making the wrong kind of noise, right? Sure. I mean, I think that's exactly what's happening, and that would be a foreshadow of what's happening. I don't doubt that the group of actors that make up like the principals in this movie that play like Leland and Bernstein and Susan Kane, they all have this theater background. And the ones that came from the Mercury Theater and they worked with him on the radio show beforehand, you know, on all sorts of different radio shows. These people are like classically trained actors. They know actual like theater, Shakespeare. They have a deep understanding and a depth of characters. And I guarantee you that these people brought with them something that you weren't typically seeing so much back then, which was like this deep understanding of the character work they were doing and really understanding the full arc and journey of the character that they're taking. And then having the opportunity to sit there and just play with these choices, when you come from the world of theater, so then you're on set, and now you're on set and you have however many hours to do whatever take that you're doing, and you of an actor have however many takes that it's going to take to get it done. And each take that happens, you keep refining those choices that you're making to the tiniest little details, and you can see that detailed work that all of these people have done. That they put that work into, especially when it's this crazy story that's not being told chronologically, which is like the first part of Orson Welles being like, I'm going to do whatever I want to do.
So after we see again more of Charlie dancing, but he takes one of the dancing girls and gives her a kiss. Then we have Jed and Bernstein have this conversation, and we do a reverse shot where we are kind of between the two of them. And they start to talk about, and we see that Jed is a little worried about saying, we thought here, we at the Inquirer, we're supposed to believe in something. We believe in something more meaningful than the Chronicle did. Well, now we've hired the Chronicle guys. So what does that mean? I mean, are they going to just adopt our policies, or are we going to slowly change because we've hired all these guys? And Bernstein isn't really following along with it. He's just kind of going, yeah, right. What kind of almost, what are you worrying about? And in the middle of the two of them is this window. And we see in the reflection, again, wonderful focus, we see Kane dancing. And so while Jed and Bernstein are having this meaningful conversation, Charlie's just having a great time. He's in a kick line with these girls and he's just dancing. And again, there's one point where you see that the ceiling is just right above his head, which again, once I see it, I can't unsee it. But while there's another nice touch here visually, where Bernstein is talking and he's clearly not really paying attention to what Leland says, Leland takes a puff of his cigar and blows a whole giant plume of it out and sort of for just a brief second covers up Kane in the image. He sort of disappears for just like a half second and covers up Bernstein a little, like he's, you know, like almost like we're those guys are being negated in a way, because we're supposed to be paying attention to what we are getting an indication of where all this is going. And that Leland, as you're saying, is like the Judas, but he's going to end up being right. He's the sole voice of reason, but you know, he's lost in the din here.
That reflection, like when I was noticing that today, when I was watching it, is just a cool shot. And I was just trying to understand like I was like, wow, they did all of this practically for sure. There's like no, it's like they were filming everything. These people were all on set that day.
Yeah, this is all done live.
Group of dancers and performers and like capturing that reflection just right and timing out this kind of turn when he's coming into the reflection is right on, I think, when he's saying his name. Like Leland is saying, or Bernstein is saying his name. And it's like, he's like, and Charles came, boom, and there he is in the shot. And it's like, they had to time all of this. They had to time it all so
well.
The choreography that went into not just the dance, but like the cinematography, the choreography of the cinematography is quite impressive in this. Yeah, dude, he just wanted to do a musical number all of a sudden. And he does a full-on musical number. I mean, it's a full-on, like, Fred Astaire, like, they go for it. Mm-hmm. And you can see the joy. You could see the joy on all of the actors' faces. This real joy coming through. This must have been the most fun this day to record. This was Orson Welles literally getting to be the song and dance man for the day, or a few days, and he probably had the greatest time.
As someone who's been on many sets, can you imagine trying to put together a shot with something like 20? Well, now, once would you get the dancers and the guy? You've got, what, about 40 people on this set at any given point?
This set, probably more. I've done, it's probably like a few hundred.
Wow.
Because of everybody else on the set, too. I definitely did a movie once, like a wedding movie that had, like, you know, dance bit with wedding guests. That is some hard stuff to coordinate. And they were doing this live. They were performing this when they were doing this. They don't look like they're lip syncing. I mean, even if they sunk up like a track to it later, they would have been performing live when they did this. It is really cool. Did you know that this song is actually like a popular Mexican folk song?
I did not know that.
Orson Welles stole this tune. It's called A Pocono. And it was written by this guy named Pepe Guizar, who was called the musical painter of Mexico for his songs that combine traditional folk music with classical elements. And so it's basically the exact same tune. I watched it earlier today, a version of a Pocono. And he just rewrote the lyrics to it to be, you know, what is his name? It was like, A Pocono. A Pocono, instead of what is his name? What is his name?
That is amazing. How did you know that before going into this, or did you read your research?
I'm not like that much of a cinephile and so educated. I'm a huge musical theater nerd, and I was like, I wonder if there's a story behind this song. And you know, lo and behold, there was. And I guess Orson Welles like decided that it was just like the perfect tune for this vaudeville style number that he wanted to do. And it says in this thing I'm reading right here, Herman Ruby, an RKO songwriter who worked on Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers films, wrote alternate lyrics that celebrated the glories of Charles Foster Kane. it says here, sample lyrics for the poor, you may be sure that he'll do all he can. That is the story. That is where that song came from. So
that's really cool. I had no idea. That's fantastic. So yeah, I mean, that wraps up the 5 minutes. Again, we know where this is all sort of headed in a bad place, but for now, Kane doesn't see any of that. He's just enjoying being a rich guy, and he can do whatever he wants. He can buy whatever he needs, and he can create a song, in his own honor, which is, you know, an amazing thing for somebody to do. And he doesn't get a sense that this is, maybe something he probably should be not spending his time doing in terms of running a newspaper. So that's going to wrap up these 5 minutes of Citizen Kane. So, well, Corey, I mean, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. We've been friends for a little while now, and I am just, I'm so fascinated by the process of movie making. I just think it seems sort of terrifying, incredibly cool. Like, I mean, that thing about Greg Tolan, like, I would love somebody to spend a couple of days with me teaching me cinematography. I have no use for it. I'm never going to shoot a movie, but I'd love to learn it. That just sounds utterly fascinating.
Well, you know, Rob, there's there's this thing that always happens before you start shooting your thing, and it's part of the production meetings that you have when you're in prep. And there will be a number of days where or weeks, it really can depend on the relationship between director and cinematographer, where you're going to create basically what your shot list is. And you're going to go through and you're going to talk about each and every one of the shots that you want to do throughout the film, how you want to, you know, you're planning it out basically. And this is where that conversation basically that Wells would have been having with Toland is, you know, going over a shot list basically. And it'll usually be directors talking about like, I love, you know, this shot that Hitchcock does in this. I want this shot in my movie to be something like that Hitchcock shot. And that's basically how shot lists can come together. And Orson Welles was doing that before people were, you know, normally doing and talking to Toland about probably other movies that he had seen and different things that he was inspired by that made him, you know, want to experiment with Citizen Kane the way that he did. So, yeah, the shot list.
That's now amazing. Now I know. So, anyway, Corey, thank you so much for coming by. You know, I always love talking to you. So thank you so much for spending some time with me talking Citizen Kane.
Thank you for having me, Bob. Can't wait for more Citizen Kane.
So, of course, everybody, if you want to follow this show, you can subscribe to any of the podcast catchers of your choice. All the back episodes are available on our website, firewaterpodcast.com. We're always talking Citizen Kane over on Twitter at CKaneMinute. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire & Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So we have our first Patreon supporter for Citizen Kane Minute, someone who wants to just be known as Slick. So thank you very much, Slick, for your support of Citizen Kane Minute. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. Come back next week for more Citizen Kane Minute.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.